Good afternoon, and thank you all for coming. There are handouts in the back, specifically on the chair. For the two folks who just walked in, you want to make sure you get one. I am Chris Weideman. I have Mary Caldera to my left and Jennifer Van Vleck, a guest participant, who I'll introduce later on. You have the handout in front of you. So you have the layout of the session as we're going to do it. This is going to take the presentation part. We'll take approximately 30 minutes, and then we need to engage you in discussion. So I hope you're not shy, because we need some input. And I'll direct you to the handout when necessary. For the past year, in Manuscripts and Archives in the Yale University Library, we have been running a project to develop and test search strategies to uncover GLBT primary source material in extant collections, and to develop a method for highlighting those materials for the research community. We want to review with you our progress to date, and after doing so, get your input on some of the issues with which we are grappling. In 2001, Arthur Kramer, brother of Larry Kramer, Yale graduate and prominent gay author and political activist, gave a sizable donation to Yale to support gay and lesbian studies at the university. The money was to be spent during the course of 5 years, and Jonathan Ketz, an arts historian, was hired as assistant professor and executive coordinator of the Kramer Initiative. During the course of his work, which included active collection of primary sources, coordinating two visiting professorships and various GLBT-related conferences, and teaching classes, Jonathan initiated discussion with the Associate University Librarian for Collection Development about the library's GLBT resources, both primary and secondary. Out of those discussions, a library-wide task force of librarians and archivists was assembled, whose charge was to explore and develop recommendations for enhancing the visibility of the library's GLBT resources. The task force specifically focused on ways to improve the visibility of new, incoming GLBT secondary sources, extant GLBT secondary sources, particularly for the years 1880 through 1980, and primary sources. I am chairing the task force, and Mary is an active member. The major recommendations developed to date for published works are better explanations in the library's online GLBT resource guide about how to find materials in the library, and enhanced bibliographic description and or the insertion of a tag, GLBTQ resource, into the MARC record of various resources identified by the task force. These resources range from incoming works from various publishers or dealers that specialize in GLBT works, to selected classic works derived from various bibliographies and conversations with faculty members. We are now developing the workflow for inserting the tag, which will be primarily done by the acquisitions department in the library, and developing estimates for how long it will take a professional cataloger to add subject headings to the approximately 300 classic titles that we have compiled. The archivists on the task force know that description of primary resources is quite problematic. Archivists were and are reluctant to ask donors if collections contain GLBT documentation and or to draw conclusions themselves from examination of the materials. It is particularly hard for researchers to find personal paper collections that might be applicable to their research unless the creator was openly gay and it is acknowledged as such in the catalog and or the finding aid. The two of us on the task force from Manuscripts and Archives decided to try to tackle this problem. The Manuscripts and Archives Project. We chose to focus our work on uncovering materials that document women's non-familial, intimate same-sex relationships. We did this for several reasons. We knew we would not be able to uncover all GLBT primary source materials in our holdings because of our limited time and resources. We chose to focus on women because historically, lesbian women have been underdocumented in archives. Further, we chose to search for evidence of non-familial, same-sex relations rather than simply lesbian or gay women or lesbian or gay women's relationships because our discussions with experts in the field and the literature suggest that there is no consensus as to what constitutes a lesbian or a lesbian relationship, nor whether the term can be applied to individuals who did not identify as such or lived in a time when the terms were not yet in popular use, primarily pre-1900. We felt that if we could at least identify and highlight materials that documented non-familial same-sex relationships among women, researchers would be able to decide for themselves how to interpret or label the materials. Our original searches in the catalog for collections in our holdings using the terms lesbian, homosexual, gay, and their variations resulted in no hits for collections documenting women. We know, however, that there were relevant holdings elsewhere in the library system that were not discoverable through the catalog, such as the papers of Gertrude Stein and the papers of Alice B. Toklas, and suspected there might be collections in our holdings as well. We therefore chose the more detailed finding aid as our entry into the collections. And I'll stop here for a second. The folks who just walked in, you want to make sure you have a handout in the back. You all set? Okay. Project Phase 1. We hired a graduate student with coursework and research skills in women's studies to review finding aids for all non-university collections, 1,669 of them, with these exceptions. All male organizations or all male collections, organizational collections unless exclusively female, foreign language collections, country collections, printed material collections, and audiovisual collections. And the first side of page one of your handout will help you follow along with this. Collections were selected as candidates for further review when they contained any of the following: correspondence between women, women's diaries, notebooks, commonplace books, scrapbooks, and other miscellaneous writings, unpublished writings by women on women's issues. Published writings were included if they looked to be particularly revealing regarding the author's perspective on women's issues, legal and/or estate papers for collections in which there was other evidence of female relationships on which estate papers would shed some light. Interestingly enough, we had a couple of isolated examples where wills that we found in collections were particularly revealing about partners, same-sex partners, and so we wanted to keep an eye out for those. Further refinement included excluding from consideration materials within collections that documented familial relationships between siblings, mother, grandmother, and daughter, aunts, and nieces, and excluding correspondence from authors known only by their initials, unless there was some mention in the paper's description clarifying that person to be a woman. The selection process resulted in 174 candidate collections for possible review. Due to time and resource constraints, we further limited our project scope to collections with materials that both matched our criteria and were dated between the 1880s and the 1920s. We chose this date range because it encompasses major institutional and cultural transformations in women's history. The formation of the modern middle class, ideologically grounded in the gender distinction between public and private spheres, the development of higher education for women, the coherence of a national women's rights movement centered around but not limited to suffrage, and not least, the emergence of the new woman, free love, and other forms of challenges to mainstream norms of gender and sexuality. Further, the date range allowed us to take advantage of manuscripts and archives, many holdings of papers documenting middle and upper middle class families in the 19th and early 20th centuries. This narrowed the potential number of collections down to 129. This was still too large a number for us, so we had to do further selection. We identified 34 collections for actual review because they contained extensive materials by women and/or looked to be of particular interest to the project on the basis of finding aid descriptions. Some collections were chosen because they included women known to have attended women's colleges or participated in women's political organizations. Some were highlighted because they featured women who remained unmarried or led otherwise unconventional lives. Others were chosen simply because they contained substantial amounts of correspondence between women. These collections varied in size from small to large. To do the actual review of the collections, we requested and were chosen to participate in an internship program in which the Yale Graduate School and the Yale Library jointly fund graduate students to do intensive work in a library department to enhance their understanding of librarianship. Our intern was Jennifer Van Vleck, who has joined us today, a fourth-year graduate student in American history with a strong background in gender and women's studies. She spent last fall, the semester, with us and was able to review 15 collections. We will hire another graduate student this fall to continue the work. Jennifer is in Washington for a year on a Yale and Smithsonian fellowship to work on her dissertation. So that's why we were able to ask her to join us today. The review process for each collection is comprised of the following steps. Number one, written review of why the collection was selected, the reasons for focusing upon the materials of specific women within the collection when multiple women are represented, and how specific materials were selected for review. Sometimes there are so many materials within a collection that meet our criteria that we have to develop a method to sample them. Selection of descriptors for the content of the materials reviewed. Transcriptions, sometimes excerpts, of samples of materials that fit the descriptors. And let's talk a little bit about the descriptors. Because we decided not to use the terms lesbian or gay in our project, we developed descriptors that focused on the actual content of the materials we reviewed. These terms identify a range of behaviors that one would expect to see evidenced in same-sex, non-familial relationships. For each descriptor applied to a collection, we felt it was necessary to indicate the extent, occasional, moderate, frequent, to which the descriptor applied. While the descriptors can apply to all same-sex non-familial relations, in the context of our project, they are understood to describe woman-to-woman relations. Additionally, if present in the right combination and frequency, the descriptors can describe same-sex sexuality while not necessarily describing or representing lesbianism, gayness, or homosexuality as we understand it today. The descriptors are located on the back of page 1, if you want to follow along. Physical intimacy, hugging, kissing, close physical contact, sexual intimacy, genital contact, physical yearning or desire, emotional yearning or desire, intense emotional or spiritual intimacy, friendship, adult same-sex cohabitation, socio-professional political networks, gender role of women, and other. In addition to the development of descriptors, the most challenging aspect of the project to date is their application. Three terms, physical yearning or desire, emotional yearning or desire, and intense emotional or spiritual intimacy, are particularly problematic, given the latent ambiguity of the emotive terms yearning, desire, and intimacy. In an attempt to minimize the questionable application of these three items, all three of us reviewed the same material and discussed the application of the descriptors. And Mary is going to continue with the results that we've had.
Okay, for the results, can you hear me okay?
No.
No? Is that better? No? Yeah? Good? Okay.
Yeah, it's on.
It's on. Am I close enough now?
Yeah, you can speak closer.
Okay. Through our work to date, we have found that primary source materials pose many challenges to descriptive categorization. Their potential value, volume and temporal range, and the fact that they can document many individuals and subjects over long periods of time makes them particularly difficult to review closely and describe selectively. We try to do so, however, and what we have found so far is as follows. Please keep in mind that our findings only apply to the portions of the collections that we examined. Of the 15 collections, breakdown is available on your handout. Of the 15 collections examined to date, there was strong evidence in 4 of same-sex sexuality as well as sexuality and gender or sex roles in general. The reviewers applied most, if not all, of the descriptors to each collection, and at least 3 descriptors applied were marked moderate or frequent, indicating that much material warranted the descriptor. 3 collections posed an interesting challenge. They are of women known to have had long-term female partners or companions, but the nature of the relationship was not clarified by reviewing the papers, at least not in the portions perused by the reviewers. The library GLBT task force struggled with the question of whether to include the works of individuals who were thought to be gay, but whose work did not clearly support the assumption in our list of secondary sources. The task force came to the conclusion that we would not. We came to the same conclusion in relation to the primary source material. So while we suspect the women represented in those papers may be gay, the records will not be highlighted as GLBT resources. 2 collections contain material most relevant to opposite sex sexuality and sexual gender norms. The reviewers either did not apply descriptors, thinking they were not applicable, or used same-sex friendship and other heterosexual intimacy. 6 collections, or 40% of those examined, contain no evidence of same-sex sexuality or sexuality in general. However, some contain evidence of women's friendships, sometimes intense, and gender-sex norms and roles. The most common descriptors applied by the reviewers to these collections were same-sex friendship and women's social, professional, political networks. So for our preliminary conclusions, we have 5 preliminary conclusions. 1, the search strategy we developed and tested was successful at uncovering same-sex sexuality resources. It can be used by repositories seeking to uncover GLBT and sexuality research sources in their holdings. Advanced researchers, too, will find the method useful. However, the method is probably too time-consuming and reliant on subject expertise for use by undergraduate or novice researchers. 2, we reviewed the catalog records and finding aids for the 4 collections in which we found evidence of same-sex sexuality and found them mostly wanting. What page is the handout for this, Chris? In the categorization, you'll find reference to these.
Oh, this is probably the second page in categorization of reviewed collections. Group 1.
So group 1 in your handout. Beecher and Donaldson would be entirely missed by researchers who relied on the catalog records and or finding aids. The Harris finding aid makes reference to the attachments of single women and describes her love for 2 men. Nothing is said, however, about her correspondence from women, which we believe show strong evidence of same-sex sexuality. The catalog and finding aid for only 1 collection, Louise Bryant, contains explicit reference to lesbian and bisexuality. It is important to note that this collection, acquired 2 years ago, was recently arranged and described in an in-depth manner. Additionally, much was known about the creator's life, including her affair with another woman, so the processor expected to find evidence of the affair in the papers. 3, isolating the behavioral descriptors implied by the term sexuality, lesbian, gay, and bisexual was critical to the success of our project. They allowed us to at least agree to the extent possible on what we were seeing. We could not have proceeded with the project, let alone share the results with colleagues, if we had not overcome that obstacle. Although it is unlikely that they will satisfy everyone, we think the descriptors can be used in other projects that try to uncover same-sex, non-familial relationships, male or female, in primary source collections. By utilizing the behavioral descriptor approach, we were able to identify more general sexuality sources. Though not our original intent, we know from discussions from faculty that these sources, too, are of interest and can be difficult to find. We can now direct researchers to the Charles McLean Andrews papers if they want to study courtship in the late 19th century, or the papers of Isabella Foster and Ebenezer Alfred Johnson if they want to study female friendship in the 19th century. 4. Some level of expertise, subject expertise, is critical to a project like this. We were fortunate to find 2 research assistants with backgrounds in history and women's studies. Without that background, the reviewers would probably have been misled by generational differences in literary styles and levels of intimacy found in the materials reviewed. And lastly, 5, if our project is any indication, there are hidden GLBT resources in many institutions. An increase in resources for the study of sexuality and same-sex sexuality does not necessarily require a new collecting initiative. Highlighting or describing the GLBT content of only new acquisitions as opposed to searching in extant collections will primarily result in modern collections being highlighted, as the probability of acquiring a 19th century resource is less likely as time goes by. We do have some unresolved issues. The most important issue we need to resolve is how much content a collection must have for us to highlight it as a GLBT resource, and whether we can use the descriptors and their frequency within a collection to help us. For example, would 1 love letter from 1 woman to another in a 65-foot collection of family papers justify highlighting the entire collection? In this case, we would apply 3 descriptors: physical yearning desire, emotional yearning or desire, and intense emotional or spiritual intimacy. And the frequency would be occasional or one letter only. Would this qualify as a collection that should have the GLBT resource tag inserted into the collection record? Would the answer to the question change if the letter was dated 1990, 1890, 1790? So going on to highlighting our findings, for the research community, we have yet to decide where the enhanced descriptors will be located, in the collection catalog record via the GLBTQ resource tag, the finding aid, and or the library GLBT online research guide. In any case, we will specifically note what part, if only part, of the collection is considered a GLBT resource. The research guide is maintained by the Librarian for Gay and Lesbian Studies and Women's Studies, who also conducts reference bibliographic instruction and informational sessions. She is often the first contact point for students conducting research in GLBT topics. It is critical, therefore, that she know what collections she should be telling folks about. We're also interested in sharing our findings with professional communities. We believe two products of our work with the Library Task Force and the Manuscripts and Archives Project have wider applicability to the library and archival professions. The GLBTQ resource tag allows enhanced access through the catalog to GLBTQ materials without committing resources to extensive retrospective bibliographic description. The tag serves to group the materials together by a broad subject category, creating a virtual collection as opposed to a physical grouping of the items. And it is an easy search strategy to explain to researchers. Use of the tag can be adopted by other libraries and can also be modified to apply to other subject areas or types of resources. The other work product that could be useful beyond Yale is the parsed, in this case behavioral, descriptor approach to identify and describe a group of resources. It is particularly useful for ambiguous and or amorphous concepts, of which sexuality is just one. The Library Task Force is exploring how to present our findings to the professional communities. Once our work is completed, we may hold a one-day conference at Yale with invited librarians and archivists to review and discuss our work. Alternative, we are exploring the possibility of hosting and or presenting at a future GLBT Archives, Libraries, Museums, and Special Collections Conference, of which one of the first was held just this year. So stay tuned on that. So that concludes the presentation part of the session, and what we'd like to do now is engage you in a discussion to get your thoughts on the work and to help us answer a few of our questions. Before we do that, though, we would like you to take a look at the last page on your handout. And it's an example of one of the letters we coded. And so I'll give you a few minutes to take a look at that. Okay, so we have about half an hour for discussion. And I have some questions for you to consider and kind of talk about and ask more and fill in some stuff. And Chris is going to, this is a recorded session, so Chris is going to be out and about in the audience if you have a comment, and hopefully you do. We had originally envisioned small groups of folks discussing, but I'm not sure that will work in this setting. So before we start with the questions we have for you, do you have any questions for us regarding the process that we described? Yes, Debbie.
I'm just curious. Hi. Well, first, I just want to thank you for doing this project. I think it's really important and valuable, so thank you for doing it. I'm just wondering, in terms of the levels, I don't think you talked about this, and I apologize if I just didn't catch it, but how did you determine the levels? I mean, frequent, occasional,
the simple answer is that there's no sort of objective quantifiable way of doing that. It was just kind of I think usually we would say frequent if there were at least five or six documents in the collection that exhibited these descriptors. Moderate would maybe be 2 or 3. But it's also proportional. I mean, if the smaller collections had a couple of really illustrative examples, we might use one of the higher levels.
I don't think that the frequency was nearly as tricky as the actual descriptor itself, which one to apply. I think it seemed to be pretty self-evident to the three of us that, okay, this warranted a moderate, this warranted a frequent, this warranted an occasional. Mary mentioned one that we didn't use, but we probably have to, one letter only, because that threw us into what do we do with it? Is it really occasional if it's only one letter? Mm-hmm. But that would seem to be fairly obvious, more so than you might think, but we didn't have a problem determining that.
Any other questions?
Yes. I came in late, so forgive me if you already answered this. Did you decide to use GLBTQ resource in the absence of other subject headings at Yale, or did you want in some way to highlight this even more than a normal subject heading that might be everything from biology to railroads?
The GLBT resource tag came out from the larger discussion of how inadequate the terms in LCSH are, library subject headings are sometimes, and also recognizing that those came into use fairly late, like mostly in the 1990s or later, and recognizing that terms have changed over time. So if you're looking in the catalog, you might find something under sexual deviant, you might find something under lesbian, and only very, very late under gay. And then sometimes it's gay male, it's gay women, or gay in general, or lesbian, or so all those discussions that are fairly well outlined in the literature was the reason we were trying to was the context for that discussion. There was another point there.
I think we were also trying to get it under-described materials without having to go back and do content analysis, because there is a certain recognition of titles out there now, either in bibliographies or that faculty members know, that when you look them up in the Yale catalog, will be cataloged under sex deviancy, that an undergraduate would never find, because they don't know to do that. And so there was, I think, also extensive discussion about how this kind of compromise between full bibliographic description that we don't have time to do, and yet some knowledge that we do have this knowledge that there are titles out there that particularly undergraduates and sometimes graduate students should be able to find fairly easily. And so that's the beauty of the tag, is that it can be inserted by a support staff member, as long as they're overseen by a professional, a support staff member can insert this tag. So I think it was a combination of both.
Okay. Anything else before we go on to...
Sure.
Go ahead. Anybody else has anything to add? This is just another question about the descriptors.
Sure.
Little nitpicky questions. I'm just curious about the tag, intense emotional spiritual intimacy. How did you decide when? I mean, I think that is really wonderful that you have that. I like that a lot. But I'm just wondering when you decided to use that versus, you know, the emotional yearning or physical yearning, or using them both. Or I just think it's good. Whoever
it's tricky. It's on the back of page 1. Good. Yep, there you go.
Okay, so thank you, Deb, for that very pushing me question. What we were trying to get at the intense emotional spiritual intimacy is kind of the changes, kind of very early romantic friendship kind of stuff, where we were getting to where... there's a lot of language about, it seemed to be often framed in the language of spirituality, this intense merging spirituality in some of these really early relationships. And that's why we kind of went with that, trying to capture that somehow, where it wasn't as explicit as desire, yearning, but there was a spiritual language that was often used to describe these emotions. Do you have more to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, just that tag in particular is historically specific in that in this late 19th century context, women often describe their friendships in terms of a sort of higher, I mean, whether it's explicitly linked to God, it's often linked to sort of sentimental notions about the universe. And so, I mean, I think that was, you know, used to describe that.
And again, what was interesting for me is this is a field that's relatively new for me, is that I'm not sure we could differentiate between intense emotional spiritual intimacy and just emotional spiritual intimacy, except I can tell you that the ones that we all read when we applied these terms for me were extraordinarily intense. To say that they were just emotionally intimate doesn't begin to capture what we were seeing, but we were seeing it primarily in these late 19th century, oftentimes women at the same boarding school or women writing about their professors, which is, you know, historically been already documented in a number of ways. But for me, it was interesting because intense it is, at least by today's standards. And I think that might have, coming up with the descriptors was not something that we just, you know, had brilliant insight one night to do. It's that we started kind of looking at this material, and we knew we had to come up with a better way to describe it, and we started thinking about ways to describe what we had read early on. And I think that's how the word intense came to be in this descriptor, because it is so intense, and that was stuff we had looked at fairly early on.
And there was some overlap. I mean, we talked a lot about the difference between emotional yearning / desire and intense emotional / spiritual intimacy, you know, because, yeah, those things are similar, but, the distinction is still a little bit.
Steve, you had a question?
Actually, you just answered it.
Okay. Good. Okay, so thank you for your comments, and we have questions for you. And do we have the questions on the handout? I forget.
No, at the end of the paper.
Okay. Yeah, got it. Okay, so our questions for you to consider and give us insight on. We have four questions, and the first is, what do you think of the usefulness of behavioral I think I'll say them all before we start jumping into discussion. So the first is, what do you think of the usefulness of behavioral descriptors as opposed to the terms gay, lesbian, bisexual, and homosexual? Two, where do you think the descriptors should be applied? Three, how much content is enough to deserve highlighting as a GLBT resource?
In some way, shape, or form.
And finally, actually I only have four, what do you think of the GLBTQ resource as local subject heading for those of you familiar with MARC? It would be in the 690 tag, with or without additional subject access such as lesbian or bisexual. So those are the things we are hoping you can help us with, and go ahead and jump in if you have a comment.
So let's start with the descriptors. Yeah. Do you buy into the descriptors? Do you think they're useful? Do you think they're a way around oftentimes the limitations in LC subject headings? Bill? I can't come all the way back there, okay. I'm sorry to say. Talk loud.
I'll talk loud.
Okay.
I think that the behavior institutions...
Point, because we were going to continue working our way through the 34 that we've chosen that are restricted by time. So I do think we have some others that would take us into the 50s and potentially the 60s, which might be interesting. And I think if those of you are kind of in agreement with that, is there anybody who disagrees? Do you think that really you want to stick with LC subject catalog headings here because that's the way to go, that's the way to standardize things, that's the way to try and make us fit, make things fit.
Although I'm not sure that they're mutually exclusive. We're not saying you can do
right,
both.
Right, you can. Okay. Yes. So this one first. We'll come back to you. Okay, go ahead.
No, I just wondered.
Other and compass.
Jennifer, how did you use other?
Well, for instance, the evidence we found of opposite sex relationships, so we thought it was important to identify that this collection might be useful for the study of the history of sexuality, but maybe not same-sex sexuality.
And I think we were trying to leave something open, and just in case we found the cross-dresser or something really juicy like that, and we wanted to leave an option, yeah. You know, leave it open for if they found anything interesting, they can put it in. It was used very little, actually.
Now I really feel like I'm on the Donahue Show. No disagreement, actually. Mary and I were talking about this yesterday, and in some ways it seems like you've cut the Gordian knot of, you know, how can we call somebody that they can call themselves? You know, it's what I call the Willa Cather question. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of a good news, bad news findings. On one hand, I think the descriptors are very useful. The bad news is, I can't imagine that many repositories being able to do this intensive work, right. Reading all these letters.
Sure.
I've got another professional on staff, which makes, you know, many of my colleagues, you know, envious of me. There are so many places where really there's just one professional. I can't imagine them doing this.
I think you're right. And it is a matter of priorities. If an institution, you know, you're getting a new gay lesbian studies program, you know, it would be a matter of priorities and deciding this is something you would like to do, certainly.
Yeah, I can't agree with you more. We're lucky that we spent probably close to 4,000 hours just to hire the grad student to search through 1,669 finding aids. And then we were extraordinarily lucky that we got Jennifer for free because the library and the graduate student paid for her. But had we gone into the 8,000 to 10,000 hour range, then we would have had to start thinking what was going on. But, you know, I will say that there is, if you can't do it yourself, you can try to tie it into sexuality classes that are being taught at your university, because we tried to. It didn't work. We didn't get any takers. But a student could write a whole paper on, you know, going after a collection, looking at it, comparing it to how it's cataloged, trying to figure out whether the cataloging just missed it or whether it could be better, and then reporting on what they're finding. So, you know, even, again, it might just be piecemeal, but there are classes at Yale that would lend itself to doing this very nicely, and we tried. We just didn't get any takers. Other hands. We saw other hands up in the back.
You have to just talk loud.
Okay.
We didn't go there. I mean, fortunately.
We stopped in 1920.
Yeah. Fortunately, we were dealing with very early ones. And possibly if there were a later a collection, that might be an issue. But we really haven't answered that question.
I think that we had some conversations with folks from the Beinecke who have experienced something just like that, where they have done something and then relatives were kind of taken aback by what was there. In part, I would answer that in a couple ways. Number one, the descriptors are helpful in that regard. They're not saying gay. They're not saying homosexual, which has so much latent kind of meaning to it, and so it can offend people or be, whatever it can do. So the descriptors, I think, applied somewhere, and we're going to come to that as our next question, will help with that. And then, we think we just have to deal with the relatives. And, you know, explain why we're doing it and how it ties in, and this is what we find, and get their feedback. I mean, it's one of those tricky donor issues that you hope never happens, but if it does, you just kind of work through it. And if they ever, you know, kind of get to the point where they're so insulted or taken aback or whatever that they want to remove the collection, well, that, you know, gets kicked upstairs then. You know? I mean, you know, theoretically they can't because they all sign deeds of gifts, and physically it's ours, but we haven't gotten there. But I think the descriptors might help that a little bit.
Should we go on to the next question, or? Yeah, okay, the next question was, where do you think the descriptors should be applied? Like, where should we put these so researchers can find them and get to the collections?
You're the cataloger. cataloger.
No, absolutely not. Definitely the finding aids are much more extensive, and while the catalogs are full according to, you know, descriptive standards, they're certainly not do not have as many possibilities as the finding aid has for us.
Well, and we have the online research guide, which is another potential place. I mean, you know, we We could conceivably have a whole section of the GLBT online resource guide devoted to manuscripts and archives, and within that display some of what we have here and explain the descriptors and do it that way, and either not do anything with the finding aid or the catalog record or some variation thereof. Insert the tag, the GLBTQ tag that we think is important. This whole, one of the biggest thorniest problems for the library task force as a whole, but also for us, is we have to come up with some type of scope note that explains what GLBTQ resource means. And that's really hard because it's subjective, because we're using a lot of sources, because, you know, try explaining this. But, I mean,
we're trying,
and we got to be able to do it. But it is also conceivable that we don't touch the catalog record or the finding aid, and instead point everybody as the starting point to the online research guide, and they start there, and then they come down from there.
It would seem to me that if you
get
your student...
That's true.
Yeah, that's
good
true.
Point. Yep. Yeah, and so if we put GLBTQ resource in the catalog record and then link to the finding aid, we would then want to do something, seems to me, in the finding aid to explain why we applied the tag to it. Bill?
I guess I'm also wondering, because, I mean, I'm doing a lot
of... Terrific.
Thank you.
Will you come do it?
If I can say something. Sure. I'm speaking as an LC cataloger, although I'm not speaking officially for LC. So you know, but I do work there as a cataloger, taking time to do that.
Okay, thank you.
And that way you have those skills quickly.
Trying to write all this stuff down.
Should come to Yale, too.
No. Okay.
And the head of cataloging in the library has been involved in these discussions on an informal basis. We are about to go to her on a formal basis regarding the tag and what we try to do with it. And she has not had problems with it at all so far with the concept of it, which we're very grateful for. I think the larger political issue is, well, if you do this for gay resources, why aren't you doing it for African American? Something like that. And that's a battle, and, you know, once again involves some larger discussions. We're just recommending this for what we were charged to do, but I think at some point there may be some other discussions.
Yes. Yes. Sometimes in the description of the papers, like for instance, there was one person's interested in attachments of single women was one. There was sometimes reference to a companion. Sometimes. I think in two cases, maybe one case, which led us to investigate further. And there was that one case of the recently arranged and described collection, which had very explicit language. But for the most part, no. I mean, nothing, you know, you have to be a little savvy in some of those earlier finding aids to even, you know, raise an eyebrow. Yeah. Okay, so go on to the next question.
Which we might have already done. No.
No. Oh, yeah, this one's tricky. How much content is enough to deserve?
What do you think of Mary's question about one love letter in a large collection? Yep, Bill.
I guess I sort of feel like if you've done
yes. Yeah, I think that's a great way of looking at it. I also think the undergraduate could have a wonderful time trying to figure out why only one letter. You know, I mean, if there's this letter, why aren't there more? Which I think is a whole, you know, could be a whole untold story. So, yep.
Can't you return?
Right. Okay. Yep. We can, one letter only, which we hadn't
talked about. I mean, one thing we are trying to avoid is frustration on the part of the researcher where there's something saying there's stuff in here and, you know, they might expect more than there actually is. So we do want to be clear on how much there is.
Yep, I think we're going to have
box
to.
And folder number.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If we found it, may as well send them right there. Yeah. Other comments? I saw. Yep.
Old-fashioned finding aids say there is one letter from
Right.
That's
right.
True. Yep. That's true.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Exactly.
The 20%. Yeah.
Right.
And
yep. I know at some point in our task force we were talking about, what, 10 to 20%?
The 20% rule in cataloging for monographs,
then it got a mention in the catalog record. You know, it may be that there have to be exceptions to that, that this is the type of subject that is amorphous and hard to find, and that you just can't use kind of those guidelines which were set up for, like letters from Sigmund Freud, as opposed to a lover who writes once. We go round and round.
And another thing, it is a matter of the catalog record, the mark record, versus the finding aid, which is, you can do all sorts of things in the finding aid, and yeah.
Right. Yeah, exactly. In the back. Sure. Are you defining the person like in the biography as being gay?
He is, yeah,
but there's other things that document his life as a gay man. Oh, okay.
And he's a gay man.
Yeah. Yep. I think that you would not be wrong if you think that, you know, but it's genre. You're saying there's a certain genre that's missing. And I think that's okay to do if you think your researchers are otherwise going to be misled and they're going to come because they think there's a lot of correspondence. I'm not so sure that's tied to content. It is more, is it, you know, just that he was an active person and you might think that he created a lot of correspondence, when in fact he didn't. Yeah, I think
they can.
I don't know why they couldn't.
We our time.
If they're open and, you know, you can get them to talk to you about what subject headings you should use. So, but what do you folks agree with us regarding, we have these three collections of women who had long-term companions that they lived with. And when you read their letters, they get letters from people saying, you know, dear Catherine and Louise, whatever. I mean, they talk about going places together. They say, I met, you know, M and we went and visited this museum. It's clear that it's a very close relationship. But that would not get our GLBTQ resource tag. I think we are going to highlight it in whatever other way we come up with, because I think that's a really interesting example that people should know about it. But we are not going to highlight it as a GLBTQ resource. Instead, it got the descriptor adult same-sex cohabitation. Is the descriptor that came up, and friendship. And friendship, right. Do you all agree with that? Is that what you would do?
I guess I would bring up one other thing. I had a similar conversation with an advisory board of an LGBT collectors.
Although trying to explain that is really, really hard. We can take one more comment, and then we have to move on, because I think the next group has this room. But in the, who hasn't talked yet?
Well, I was just going to say, I'm sure you...
Yeah. And I suspect we're going to say no, because that would eliminate a lot of collections. But we might have something very specifically just to talk about adult cohabitation. Because I think that, again, you know, what Jonathan Katz told us, and bless his heart, because he was great for us, was, you know, Jonathan looks at basically at sexuality. No labels, you know, it's going to be reinterpreted, and what you don't find is important as what you do find, and what you do find means one thing today, it could be something totally different 100 years from now. We call people lesbians today. Who knows 100 years from now whether that's what that generation is going to say defines lesbian, if that term is even around. So in other words, broad. Think broadly and understand, going back to something we said early on in the paper, get the researcher to the materials, let the researcher decide how to interpret them, how to label them, because it'll change. But finding the materials won't necessarily change. So thank you very much. You've been a great audience, and thank you for coming.